This is Stories of New Americans with Ron Clutho, featuring inspirational and fascinating personal stories of people from all corners of the globe who are now in St. Louis. We'll take a look at the U.S. through newcomers' eyes, get some insight into world history and cultures, and maybe learn something about ourselves. Stories of New Americans on News Talk STL.
Welcome to Stories of New Americans tonight. This is a very special episode, which doesn't really involve New Americans, but it's something I have felt strongly that I wanted to do for a long time. This coming Monday, October 23rd, is the 40th anniversary of a cowardly, barbaric attack on our Marine base in Lebanon in 1983. And I wanted to take this time to commemorate that. I would like to make sure that we don't forget about this. I'm afraid that many people have forgotten about it or maybe don't even know about it, but I think it's very important to keep the memory alive just to learn from history, but also I think it's very important to honor the memory of our fallen heroes. We lost 241 heroes that day, including a cousin of mine, and so it's kind of personal for me. My cousin, First Lieutenant Scott Sommerhoff, was among those who did not survive that attack. He's a hero. And so I've invited his mother and brother to come and share some of their memories about Scott, my Aunt Jo Sommerhoff, and my cousin John Sommerhoff. So thank you for coming today. And also I've invited Johnny Harper to come, who is a Marine who was there and thankfully survived the attack. I met Johnny because he has been writing editorial pieces that appear sometimes. Sometimes the local newspaper will publish them on the anniversary, not every year, unfortunately. But I read his editorials, and I got in touch with him through the paper, and we've kind of kept in touch. And I wanted him to share his thoughts about his experience there and what he's doing. I know he's doing a lot to try to keep the memory of the fallen heroes alive. So please indulge me tonight. This is not a story of New Americans, but this is a very important story that I think we all need to hear and we all can learn from. So I think I'm going to start with Aunt Jo and Cousin John. So let's talk about Scott. He was, I think, 24 or 25 when he passed away. But what was he like as a boy? And how did he decide to go into this profession? Please, go ahead.
As long as I can remember back as a young boy, if there was ever anything he liked to play, it was soldier. And back then, you could actually find little camouflage suits and things. Well, he had them, and mm-hmm. the slouchy hat and the whole thing. I don't know how his baby brother felt about it, but he had his two brothers. They were always playing war, and he was destined to be a soldier.
Yeah. And I think there was another big influence on him, and that my, you know, both my dad's dad was a Marine. Your father was in the Army.
Mm-hmm.
All of her brothers were in the Army serving in World War II. My dad served in Korea. His brother died in Vietnam.
Yeah.
All of his
uncles. Green Beret, right?
Green Beret mm-hmm. in Vietnam. His other uncle was Uncle Roy.
Mm-hmm.
Was so, and we have another uncle who was a full colonel in the Army. Mm-hmm. There's military history in our background, and I mm-hmm. think that really shaped how Scott thought and what he moved him in that direction.
Yeah. It definitely did.
Yeah.
His two uncles were very, very dear to him, and he
Uncle
looked
Earl
up to them.
Uncle
Earl,
right?
Yes.
And Uncle Bill.
And then Uncle Bill. He was in World War II, of course, and then the Korean conflict and Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then Earl, of course, joined the Army, mm-hmm. and he became a member of the Special Forces. They were called Green Berets
right.
back in that day.
Right.
So it was a big influence in our mm-hmm. in John's brother's life,
mm-hmm.
and we just all understood it. And
you encouraged it. You were okay
totally
with it?
Encouraged it. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So it was no surprise when he decided that that's what he was going to do,
mm-hmm.
and so he He was accepted at the Virginia Military Institute as well as the University of Illinois. Mm. So he opted to go to college in Champaign, Illinois, mm-hmm. the U of I. And he
It was the Navy. The ROTC program.
It was a Navy ROTC with mm-hmm. a Marine option. Mm-hmm. So he and several others were Marine options, and that's mm-hmm. how he went through his 4 years mm-hmm. at the University of Illinois.
Okay. Do you have any memories, John, of him? You were pretty young when
you know,
he
passed
away.
I was really young. I mean, there was close to 8 to 9 year difference between the two of us. So, I mean, you know, of course I have fond memories of holidays and my brother and the fun things we did and mm-hmm. being down at my grandfather's farm with him and doing all the fun things we did. But, you know, really he had left the house and I was pretty young to go to the University of Illinois. And when he graduated from U of I, he was off and running. We didn't see a lot of Scott mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. he was on deployment or training or whatever. But so, I mean, I feel cheated in that sense that I did miss out you know, on that part of getting to know him like a brother as an adult. And if there's anything that I feel cheated about, it is that.
Right.
Personally, anyway.
What did you hear from him after he joined, when he was in basic training and when he was on these deployments? What kind of messages did you get from him?
His letters were incredible. And sometime when you're at my house, I'd love to share them with you.
I'd love to see them.
Because they were very loving letters, mm-hmm. but particularly when he was sent to Beirut, we knew exactly what was going on in Beirut.
Yeah,
it wasn't in the news. Right. Their hands were pretty well tied to how what they could do.
Yeah.
But his letters are very clear, and that they were actually one of their captains was actually shot. They were out on patrol and sniper or whatever.
But they were never dire. They were never worrisome or dire, just pretty factual
letter.
And mm-hmm. here's what we did today.
And he had no regrets.
Oh, no. None whatsoever.
I don't think he would have wanted to be anywhere else.
Wow.
That's why he joined the Marine Corps. He just got put into a
– And going to Lebanon
situation.
Was – No. Just one more
– It was – It was kind of a strange, if you think about the Marines, they're not trained to keep peace. They're trained to make peace.
Right.
So the whole concept of sending this contingency of Marines as peacekeepers was a little bit strange.
Yeah. It didn't work in Bosnia either.
No, they're there to bring it about, not to keep it.
They know what
to do.
So
their hands were tied.
That must have been frustrating too.
Very.
Okay. Well, let me talk to Johnny for a minute. You're from Memphis. You're not from these parts.
No.
And how did you – what was your childhood like and how did you decide to join the service?
Well, my father was a Marine and my grandfather was in the Navy. Mm-hmm. My great uncle was in the Navy and the Air Force, retired from one and the other as a pilot. Growing up with six kids in a family, and I was born in Memphis, moved to Arkansas when I was 11, and my father's from North Mississippi. His father
Real
was a sharecropper.
Boy.
Oh, yeah, he was a sharecropper. His dad was a sharecropper. My dad grew up in a dirt shack, in essence. But my father instilled work ethics in us kids from the time I started my first job at 8 years old. Mm-hmm. But, you know, growing up with a family that big, obviously a lot of laughter. You know, my father was a Marine. My father was very regimented, to say the least, and very strict and structured, and which we all benefited from. I grew up in a time where, if you didn't get a spanking, you weren't doing something right, you know. And my father had a way of doing that, as did my mom, and they're today still with us today. Mm. But, you know, growing up with six kids, but I was also I was a middle child, so I was a ham, apparently. That's what they say. So I always was fighting for attention because there was a boy and already a girl. I was a second boy, and there were three more behind me, so I had to fight for my attention. So I did what I could to make sure I got attention as a child, apparently, from what my parents say.
Apparently.
But, you know, again, I've got, three brothers, two sisters, and we're all very close, and my parents work very hard to make sure we are all very close. So I grew up. You know, went to high school in Arkansas, went to Arkansas State in 1980. Then I decided school wasn't for me, so I left. I moved to Mississippi, working three or four jobs, trying to go to night school. And the company I was working for, Citgo Oil, was bought out, and I was just a mail clerk at the time, and they were moving, relocating to New Orleans, and they weren't going to bring me. So I had to do something, and it's because of my benefits, insurance, all those things. So I decided to join the Marine Corps at that time. So.
And did your family support that?
My father, interestingly enough, my father was not initially, because I went ahead and swore in, and then I called him, and I told him, I said, Pop, I said, I want to let you know I'm joining the Marine Corps. And he's like, you better come home before you move forward with that. And there was silence on the phone. And he went, you swore in, didn't you? I said, yes, sir, I did. Of course, I've always been that way. I've always been my own person and made up my own mind. And he kind of knew that. But my father was not the exemplary Marine that I would have liked to work with when I was in the Corps. He was we would consider a rock, and I assure you, Scott might have said that mirrored many times. You had to drag them on or kick them up, get them a move. And my dad was not a good Marine, so I think that's why at that time he had that hesitancy. But as the older he got, the more nostalgic he got about the Marine Corps. So he became very proud, and is everything he had, his house is Marine. I mean, he's just such a way he is now.
Okay, so then you joined, and then where were you sent? Where did you go for your training?
I went to Parris Island. I joined the Marine Corps in Jackson, Mississippi, and the AFE's there. Typically, people on the other side of Mason-Dixon from Mississippi have to go to California. But Jackson, Mississippi, uniquely, is one of those places you can decide whether you go to the West Coast or to the East Coast. And knowing my father went to Parris Island, there was no option for me. I knew I had to go to PI. So I went to Parris Island for recruit training.
How tough was that?
You know, I was one of the oldest guys. I turned 21. I celebrated my 21st birthday at recruit training MCRD in South Carolina. So they made sure to take care of me on my birthday. I was an older guy. So I'd already left home at 18 and was working and going to school. And so I was more mentally prepared for it, I guess. The first 2 weeks were challenging. And obviously things have changed since Scott, when he went through training and I went through training. Politics and things got involved in changing what we do and what we could and couldn't do because they couldn't do what they did to us back then. But, 12 weeks, I survived. I survived and, came out. I was meritoriously promoted out of Parris Island. After PI, went to Camp Geiger, Camp Lejeune, Camp Geiger, and went to infantry training school. I graduated and went to class there, so I was promoted again to Lance Corporal. Then we found out we were going to Lebanon.
Yeah.
And that's when that happened.
Well, let's talk about can you kind of maybe any of you or all of you can talk about what was going on in Lebanon at the time? Why were we sent there? What was the backdrop for people that might not remember?
And at that time, 1983, we didn't have internet. You didn't have all the access to the venues to information. So we were briefed. We really didn't know. We were just following orders. We knew that we were going over there as a peacekeeping force, which to your point, Joe, was like, really? Okay. But we did, and we actually there was a boot camp there that we were training the Lebanese soldiers because they were so poorly trained. But again, we have perimeters and we have places that we took watch between the American Embassy and the U.S. Embassy and the University of Beirut, American University of Beirut. But really, there wasn't a lot of information. So most of us went into it pretty blind, as to what to expect or what we were doing there. We were following orders.
I've got a there's an old – I remember Leatherneck magazine, and I think Scott had that. And after the fact, they had this political cartoon. And it was like an NCO talking to a grunt, and the grunt's like, why are we here? And he's like, we're here to keep the Muslims from killing the Christians, but this faction of the Muslims hate this faction of the Muslims, but we also got to keep the Israelis at bay, and we all have to do this when there's 3,000 years of bloodshed involved. So it was an impossible situation from the beginning.
Right. Yeah. It was. It truly was. Again, we were following orders.
Were you given any kind of cultural training before you went, like about Lebanon or Middle Eastern culture or Arab or Muslim culture?
No.
Nothing?
Nothing. No, not that I remember. It's been a while. It's been 40 years. But no, I remember nothing like that.
I think at the time – I mean, you didn't know at the time going in, but you know now – let's talk about, like, John, you mentioned all these different players, and can you, in a nutshell, talk about what the factions were and why they were at, you know, at odds with each other and why we had to intervene?
I think it went back, you know, it goes back before time.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, what I've read, and I've read a lot of books, you know, about just the politics of it.
Yeah.
And really, I don't think the diplomats and the powers that be knew why they were. They just thought, oh, we'll put a bunch of Marines there and these people will settle down and go away.
Yeah. Well, addition to you guys, there were Italians and French there,
Italians
too,
and
right?
French, right. And, you know, basically what was going on was civil war.
Right.
Yes.
You had families fighting families. I met guys, Lebanese soldiers, and they had killed their family members, you know, adamantly and proudly admitted they killed their uncle or their brother or because of you've got the Christian, you've got the Muslim aspect. You had multiple factions over there, and they all had their own ideas of what should be done. And it was just, again, like Don, you said, it's been going on for years.
Well, and at the same time, I think it's – correct me if I'm wrong, but I think you had Syria from the north and Israel from the south, right?
Right.
And occupying – half of each occupied the northern and the southern half of the country. There were also a lot of Palestinian refugees there and in a refugee camp. And as you said, it's sort of a – I think Lebanon's probably 50-50 Muslim Christian, if I'm not mistaken.
That's pretty close, I think, yeah.
It didn't only fall along those lines, but that was another fault line, I guess, religious but also mm-hmm. political. And the Iran was sort of backing Syria, I guess, at the time. And so they just plopped you guys down there without any of that cultural training.
Yeah, again, it's been 4 years and my memory's decent. I remember no training or no – maybe on geographics, you know, maybe mm-hmm. geographics there was, but nothing about the cultural history because they really didn't care to tell us because you're going to walk patrols, you're
going to – They just said you're going.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
Now you were in the – basically in the airport, right?
When?
I mean, your barracks was located in the international airport. No, why was that?
It was actually north of the airport itself, Beirut International Airport, and there was a giant parking lot between the airport and then the battalion headquarters, the BLT. And that giant parking lot was a big parade ground, so to speak, and we had a position, a sandbag position right in the middle of it to watch all the areas. But the building that we were in, if I could describe, if you ever gone to Embassy Suites, when you walk in, they've got the open center with the different levels going up on the floors. Well, that's what the BLT looked like when you walked in. It looked like it was an old four-star hotel. Mm. Now, there were no windows and, you know, no electricity, all those things. But that's the way it was shaped. And it was also had three stories underneath. There were three levels of tunnels underneath the battalion headquarters because Beirut had tunnels all over the place from the embassy to the airport. Mm. And there were battles that were fought down there as well. Mm. And, you know, we went down there. We weren't supposed to check out what it was. And we could see the mines. They had anti-personnel mines there. Okay. You could see where there had been firefights down there with all the walls and stuff. But it would – yeah, so the airport – we were very close to the airport.
Okay. I think we need to take a short break here. But we're going to come right back and pick up the story and talk about October 23rd. So – you're listening to Stories of New Americans on News Talk STL 101.9 94.1.
Stories of New Americans with Ron Clutho on News Talk STL. Stories of New Americans.
Brought to you in part by Arnell's Hardwoods. For all of your laminate and hardwood flooring needs, call them at 314-397-3252.
Stories of New Americans.
Brought to you in part by the Indoor Comfort Team. For all of your heating and cooling needs, call the Indoor Comfort Team at 314-230-9542.
This is Stories of New Americans with Ron Clutho on News Talk STL.
Welcome back. We're talking with Johnny Harper and Joe and John Summerhoff about October 23rd, 1983. I think it's officially called the Beirut bombing, right?
Yeah. Okay. Yes.
So you were, Johnny, you were describing the place where you were. What do you remember the date that you arrived?
I think it was May 18th or May 23rd, 1983, and we left November 19th
okay.
of that year.
And now we talked about all the different factions there, but I think one of the things you guys were doing was sort of working with and training and supporting the Lebanese army, right?
Correct.
Lebanese armed forces, which was, I guess, maybe predominantly Christian, but it was multi-ethnic and multi-religious, right?
Yes, but predominantly it was Christian.
Okay.
Well, it was Christian in that part of the Lebanese army.
Uh-huh. And how much did you interact with the Lebanese?
Well, every position, every outpost that was in Beirut was American-Lebanese position. So we shared a post with – so any post I was at, no matter what it was, there were Lebanese soldiers there as well. So every day, mm-hmm. every day. Even when we went on patrol, sometimes the Lebanese would go with us as interpreters or something like that,
okay.
those that spoke English. But we were directly in contact with the Lebanese soldiers every day. And they weren't trained well. Of course, we dealt with the Israeli as well, the Israeli army as well, as allies, of course. We dealt with the Lebanese army every day, and these poor guys had been fighting, watch fighting for their entire lives, and there were kids that had shrapnel wounds from
they're pretty young.
It was amazing, and a lot of these kids had American names from former.
Really?
The vets that were there.
Now, our embassy was attacked also there. Were you there?
Yes,
then?
That was in April. That was in April.
Okay.
It was attacked, car bomb in front of it that brought that down. That was one of the first things that happened.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what initiated, I think, our presence.
Okay.
The bus going to Beirut.
Yeah. Now, I read, maybe I'm wrong, that perhaps one of the reasons for the attack was that we were seen as favoring the quote-unquote Christians because we were supporting the Lebanese army, which happened to be ostensibly Christian, in air quotes. Is that
right? No, I certainly believe that's part of the logic behind the attack, but I'm sure they're deeper. I don't know if you remember Rocky Sigmon here in town.
Yeah.
That was Iranian in Iran.
Mm-hmm.
The same gentleman that was involved in his situation was involved in ours. He and I met and talked about it. Same guy, both instances. I'm drawing a blank on his name right now, so I apologize. But I think there were more reasons there than just that.
Okay.
They wanted to make a statement. They wanted to and again, the way they designed the attack, they knew exactly what they were doing. They did it on Sunday morning.
In the morning.
Well, yeah, 6:30 in the morning. So they knew Sunday is like a holiday in the military. You sleep in if you didn't have patrol or you weren't, doing something. So they knew what they did to hit the mass casualty rate. Over the years, I've looked at redacted intelligence forms and reports on the attack, and there's questions that I've never been answered from Naval Intelligence, Marine Corps, from of course, Colonel Garrity was given the blame, but he, like everybody else, was given their orders, was following orders. So you've got to have somebody to take that blame. Of course, he now is in a wheelchair.
He's from St. Louis.
He's from St. Louis, right? His niece is good friends with my wife.
Really?
And of course, he wrote the book.
Yeah,
they came in peace.
Johnny, is it Hezbollah that committed the attack? Do we know who it was?
Iran is where most of the blame is. The Hezbollah, Iran has taken the blame. Of course, they were sued. There was a suit, and of course, from the assets that we've held on to, and they're families of those that were lost and living survivors that were on Ground Zero that have actually received funds from Iran.
Mm-hmm.
I've got friends that are actually – I mean, they've called me. The attorneys have called me about that.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't – no one would have trouble taking money from Iran. I wouldn't take it from America, but I'd sure take it from Iran.
So we are pretty sure that they were behind it. Okay. Can you – I know it's not easy, but can you just briefly kind of describe that day and how – where you were when it happened and how it happened and what time and everything? October 23rd, 1983.
I'll do my best.
Take your time.
That weekend, of course, this happened on a Sunday. 2 weeks before that, I was moved over to the American University of Beirut, where we had a perimeter set up there in the American Embassy and the British Embassy. So me and my group, we were actually working the visa lines, protecting the embassies and also the University of Beirut, American University of Beirut, because there were American professors there. And when that time ended, because they transferred us around throughout the whole time we were there to make sure the enemy could not get patterns, though they did. They did anyway. So on this Saturday, October 22nd, my group was moved back to battalion headquarters to go back to our units. And my company was at the end of the airport. We had a perimeter around the runway of the airport. That's where Bravo Company was. So we got to battalion headquarters early afternoon, and of course we were all hanging around, and we were told we could stay there the night because if you go back to the front line, you're going to get the graveyard shift, which is midnight to six. And I hadn't seen my buddies, so I wasn't worried about that. But that day, I think there was a USO thing going on, and just normal activity. Saturday, they had the grills going and all those things. In the building, the battalion headquarters down below, I think the second floor down, there was a theater. And they had a bar, if you call it, with warm German beer where you could go, hang out and watch a reel-to-reel movie, I think. But I decided, hung out for a while, we played basketball, and then I said, I'd go back to the front line to see my buddies because I didn't care about getting working midnight from midnight to six. So that's what I did. And that later that afternoon, they took us back down the runway, and I met my position on the end of the runway with my bunker that we built. Me and my buddies and my fire team we built. Actually, we acquired, I hate to use the word stole, but we acquired a plane wing from the airport that we put on top of our bunker and then put sandbags on top of that. So the engineers came by one time and said, you guys could withstand a 40-millimeter round direct hit. So you'd be deaf, but you could withstand it. But so when I got back there, of course, true to their word, I got the midnight to 6 a.m. And so that night, that night when I was on post, of course, every night you heard the prayers on loudspeakers. And from the mosque, all night long. And I always wondered what they were saying. And I learned a lot of Arabic when I was there because we were with Lebanese soldiers, and I would teach them English, and they would teach me Arabic. But I didn't find out till later what they were saying. And had we all knew how to speak and hear Arabic, we would have known they were celebrating the martyrdom of this guy the night before. That was found out
years
later.
The one who later committed the attack.
Yeah, in their prayers. But so we were clueless, obviously, to that. So the next morning, my relief came, and we were – this was years ago, and we were sitting out on a sandbag smoking, hanging out because obviously I didn't have to go on patrols. I could go to bed. And then we felt and heard the explosion, not knowing what it was. We actually heard things landing. That's how far the debris was thrown. And then we turned around. We saw the mushroom cloud. Over battalion, and still didn't know what it was. We knew that the direction it was in, but we couldn't see anything. And most people forget that 60 seconds later, the French embassy was hit. Right. So there are photos of the mushroom cloud, the BLT in the background. You see a small mushroom cloud of the French embassy going up as well. And when that happened, when that smoke cleared, of course, comm went crazy because at the BLT, that's where comm was. That's where intel was. That's where everybody was, headquarters was. So it just stopped. And when the smoke cleared, we could see it was gone. Because of the building having tunnels underneath, the building was actually – it was concave, the ground. It was actually because it fell.
Yeah.
It fell. And then it became the – we heard there was another attack, imminent attack, so we had to beef up our security and being ready for another attack. We heard there were APCs or small Amtraks that we have loaded with explosives that were going to attack us. So obviously the alert was quadrupled in that respect. But and that's when we realized that we knew we lost a lot of people.
And then you guys spent the day basically doing what you could to –
yeah, we digging out, pulling out rubble, pulling out sand, sleeping bags, trying to find here. If we could, with the smoke and the, you know,
that would be the hard part to keep going over in my mind. I bet. Let's take a break, Johnny. Take a drink. Let me talk to Joe and John. When did you get word that this had happened and that Scott had been killed?
Well, what I remember is we saw it on the news.
Did you?
Yes. I remember I was asleep mm-hmm. 2 days before my birthday.
Mm-hmm.
And either you or Dad came to the room and were like, hey, something happened in Beirut.
Yeah,
when did you hear from him last?
His last letter was written on the, I think it was the 21st of October.
And then it came after it was written on the 21st? So it came later?
Came later, yes.
Wow, okay.
Yeah. And it was just his usual letter.
I remember going up and we were all glued to the TV.
Oh, yeah, sure. Because we hadn't received any calls or anything.
But he had sent a photo, I'm staying here.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Picture that building with an arrow drawn of where it
was. And he was on on the second floor.
Third floor, right under that open parking mm-hmm. bay mm-hmm. underneath it. Mm-hmm. I think in our hearts we were like, maybe he wasn't in there.
Yeah.
You know, but I think in our heart of hearts we all knew.
Did you get an official message from the government?
It took several days.
Oh, I think it was closer to a week.
A week, although after we saw the rubble and so forth.
And the coverage.
We knew there was no way he could have survived that because we knew where his room was. And
as you said, Johnny, they chose the time when people would be sleeping.
Sure. Yes.
So we just waited and waited, and then the
cliche, the car pulled into the driveway.
Did that really happen?
The Marines get out and dress uniform, really and you're like, oh, my God, this is real. And it was
– came in and made the announcement, that his body had been discovered.
Right.
God, what do you say when you hear that message?
Well, we were pretty well anticipating it. Yeah. Not that that helps, but when you saw the rubble, it would be impossible to have survived it because we knew exactly where his room was.
And not to add something, but, you know, on top of this,
mm-hmm.
almost a year prior to this, my other brother, Eric, had died in a car wreck almost to the day
mm-hmm.
that Scott was killed in Beirut a year earlier.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we were numb from that still.
I remember that.
And then got this double whammy, and it was pretty rough.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
Terrible. Johnny, can you maybe share little anecdotes about a couple of your buddies that you lost there? Just maybe what they were like. You know, just some not about this, but just what they were like.
Yeah.
What kind of people they were.
One of my two of my buddies, Terry, was Scott Schultz, was the youngest Marine in the battalion. He actually was going to cut the cake on the Marine Corps birthday because you have the youngest Marine, the oldest Marine in the unit to do that.
Oh.
And just a little kid. And he was his name was Schultzy. And, you know, I think about him a lot, you know, because obviously he was so young, you know, in different presentations I've done. I go back to him going, this young man, 18 years old, never got to do so many things. No, he died a hero, as they all did. But he was a funny kid. He's very young, you know, couldn't even drink. You know, well, it didn't stop him in the Marine Corps, of course, but couldn't drink legally in the U.S. But he was just – everybody liked him. He was just – he was like the little guy, right? Because he was very small in stature. But he always had a big smile, had a big old gap in his teeth. And but he was just a really good young man, and he was on mess duty. So at the mess hall at the battalion, you had so many people from every unit, you know, to be there to serve and shout. And that's where Scott was. Scott was there. But another buddy of mine, Terry, was a recon, and he was in the building, and he personified recon. He was crazy, you know. He made everybody laugh. He's the kind of guy we'd go rappelling, off of a cliff, and he's the kind of guy who would set a dare that, okay, whoever stopped the rope last wins the money. We put up money. He would hit the ground. You'd actually see the dust. His butt hit the ground in dust. Okay, you win. You win. But full of life, you know, just full life, just that attitude. And he was a hard charger, as we would say in the Marine Corps. And those are the two of the guys that I think about.
Thanks for sharing that. I read that book by Tim Garrity that you mentioned. He was the commander there. And I want to read a quote from the book. He wrote this about General Paul Kelly, who was the
PX commandant.
Big guy, the right. Head cheese. And this is a quote from General Kelly, I guess the day after the 23rd, when he was witnessing all of you guys, your heroic efforts to try to help and save your brothers. He said, "I saw caskets of those Marines, sailors and soldiers who had been so very much alive and full of youth and vitality during my visit to Beirut several weeks earlier. On this cold and windswept night in a distant land, I watched as young airmen from our Air Force respectfully and tenderly removed each casket and one by one, and I silently asked the question, 'Lord, where do we get such men?'" So where do we get such men? Where do we get these? What makes a Marine? How are we so blessed to have people like this? Maybe you too, if you have any thoughts.
Well, obviously, from your stand, your stand was, well, God. He had a history.
He had a history,
of serving.
It was the only thing that he ever talked about doing. And I think he was influenced by his two uncles, mm-hmm. his Uncle Earl, who died in Vietnam.
You know what? We grew up proudly patriotic.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, we believed in this country. Mm-hmm. We thought it was worth fighting
Most
for.
Most of us did in those days.
Yes.
You know, it wasn't even a thought to disrespect this country or have a, you know, negative view. I mean, that's just how we were raised, and that's how our family was. And I think it was just mm-hmm. part of duty. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, I screwed around after that in college, and I talked to my dad about joining the Marine Corps after the fact, and mm-hmm. he said, "No, you're going to kill your mother." But I mean, I joined the Coast Guard and went into the Coast Guard for 4.5-5 years.
Yeah.
Came out a different person, but I think it was just that sense of duty that we all had,
mm-hmm.
you know. I mean, if that,
why have we lost that?
Or you know,
why have we lost that as a country now? I don't think there's that much pride anymore, especially for the Marines and the military.
I think that's a whole different topic.
Yeah,
I know that's another episode.
You know,
probably shouldn't. But
yeah,
I just think the world has changed so much.
Yeah,
there are generations today that have not been taught to be patriotic, that have not been taught to
Absolutely.
Respect and honor
the
country and the military, that don't understand the freedoms they have. Everything they do each and every day was paid by somebody. Mm-hmm. Somebody sacrificed for you to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I just think that we as Americans, we as patriots, need to teach our children, you don't know what you have and you don't know the price that was paid for it.
Right.
Every day I take my son to school and ask him two questions. Ask him what he's grateful for and ask him what he can do.
Yeah.
To glorify God, that day. Because I want my son to know how blessed he is. But I want him to know we can always do better. Each day of our lives, and that's what we're supposed to do.
Do you – I know you've talked a lot about this. Do you give presentations in schools sometimes?
I have. I have. For schools and businesses and Rotary clubs, and mm-hmm. I actually was on a speaker series with the FBI years ago,
mm-hmm.
Talking. And the presentation was about Beirut, because so many people don't know about it, don't understand the history or what happened, the day to day activities we've talked about. So I'm happy to do that. Anything I can do to make sure they honor Scott and the other men, and remember them, and know, I'll do it. I'm happy to do it.
Thank you for that. On that note, we're going to take another short break here, and then we're going to come back and talk more about efforts now to keep memory of our heroes alive. You're listening to Stories of New Americans on News Talk STL 101.9.
Stories of New Americans with Ron Clutho on News Talk STL.
Stories Stories of New Americans.
Brought to you in part by Samim Afghan Restaurant, featuring traditional Afghan cuisine and conveniently located on Manchester Road in the Grove.
Stories of New Americans.
Brought to you by Hacking Law, for individuals who want to come and stay in the U.S. Hacking Law fights for immigrants every day. Visit them at hackingimmigrationlaw.com.
And I'm proud to be an American, where at least I know I'm free. And I won't forget the men who died, who gave that right to me. And I gladly stand.
This is Stories of New Americans with Ron Clutho on News Talk STL.
Welcome back to Stories of New Americans. We're talking with Johnny Harper, Joe Sommerhoff, and John Sommerhoff about the 1983 Beirut bombing, 40th anniversary of which will be in 2 days from the date this show is going to air, October 23rd. Now, there is a memorial, something in North Carolina near Camp Lejeune, right? Can you talk about that?
Well, Camp Lejeune obviously is the big base, but the memorial itself is at Camp Geiger.
Okay.
1st Chinese Marines was stationed at, were there at Camp Geiger at that time. And the memorial is – it's a wall with all the names of all the men we lost. And there is a bronze statue of a Marine in the uniform of that time. Mm-hmm. And it's a beautiful – I mean, they've nailed the – have you guys been able to see it?
Yeah.
Yes.
They've nailed from the dog tag, from the dog tag in the shoe, the dog tag in the boot that they have. But it's a beautiful memorial.
So you're satisfied with it?
Oh, yeah. Okay. I think they did a wonderful job.
It is.
And when was it dedicated?
I can't remember what year it was.
Was that the 20th anniversary?
Mm. Was that what it was? I can't remember. I'll be there.
When?
Yeah, we've been there. We went several times. Yeah. Anytime they had something going every October 23rd for years, and so we went several times, and it was always very impressive, very well done. If you go, if the military is going to do it, they're going to do it right.
Right.
Yeah.
And they do.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, Johnny, you said that you have spoken in schools before, but I met you, as I said, because you had written an editorial that the Post published, I guess, I don't know, 10 years ago or something. So what other efforts are you putting forward to keep the memory alive? And how do you find the emotional strength to do that?
Well, it's what I'm supposed to do, first of all. It's what I'm supposed to do. Every year I send a letter and I send a picture of the Beirut blast to every radio station, every news station I can, and I ask them, just share it.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to talk to me. The letter, it's not about me. Share this. People don't know about it. People have forgotten about it. And I know a lot of things have happened in 40 years. I get that. We've had a lot of other things happen with our country and other wars, but just show it. Just please just show it. And sometimes they do and most of the time they don't. Currently, this year, I started working on getting with our Missouri governor and our legislators to try to see if we can have October 23rd a day where all the government buildings fly flags at half-mast. And that's been a chore. And with your help, Ron, looks like we're moving closer to happening. It's now in the governor's hands.
It might even happen this year.
It could happen this year because the governor could do it like a one-time thing.
Yeah.
But then we've got to get with the different representatives to create a bill so we have it set in stone for every year. So legislation will be involved in drought right now. They won't be until the first of the year. So maybe next year it'll happen. But anything we can do to make people know and remember, that's what I want to do. That's what I want to do.
And then, Aunt Jo, you had an idea also as a way to commemorate this. Can you share your idea that hasn't come to fruition yet, but maybe will?
Would you refresh my memory?
The stamp?
Oh, the stamp. Oh, yes. We fought for actually years, shortly after the Beirut incident, to get a stamp, good old U.S. postage stamp, and to no avail. There was no interest in it whatsoever.
Did they just ignore your request or did they say, no, we don't want to do it?
They just – number one was ignored for a long time, but there are those, you know, tenacious people who keep going after that sort of thing. And then finally, it was just the post office just said absolutely not.
Well, now the 50th anniversary will be next year, and I think that's something.
10 years.
10 years.
Yeah, 10 years.
What did I say? Next year.
The 50th will be next. Not we next year. It'll be 10 years.
Ten years.
Okay.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
Right.
That's the next big.
You know, the big milestone, and so that might be something we can work on for the 50th.
But you know, it was very discouraging because you know they give movie stars.
I know.
Stamp and
yeah.
Yeah, I think it's a wonderful
the
idea.
The daffodil.
It's a wonderful
and all
idea.
This.
It's a great idea.
Well,
John, go ahead.
When you talked about people remembering, and you know, it's something that's just not in the cultural conscience of people. But where me and my wife own a business, and this guy had come in, and we were doing work for him, and he was in the Marine Corps, and I mentioned, oh, you know, my brother, and he every Marine I've ever met, I mentioned that to him, and they're always, you know, heartfelt, whether they were in at that time or they were out at that time, whatever. But this guy went on to work for the State Department, and he was a security expert with the State Department. And he made a point of coming back in, and he said, I just want you to know, and maybe this isn't a great thing, he said, but the State Department uses that incident, and they've used that incident to make security better across the world for U.S. military bases. You know, hate to say it, but what not to do.
Right.
So there is some, I guess if you're going to look at something positive that came out of it, it opened the eyes of security and how we protect, you know, soldiers and, you know, Americans overseas.
I didn't know that. Yeah. It's good to know.
And he made a point of coming back in and saying, just to let you know, this is what we, how we use that.
That's cool.
And you all, you said you left in November then. The Marines all just left.
We were replaced. We were replaced by another.
But there was still a Marine presence there after that?
Yes.
Okay. All right.
And when I got the Marine Corps, they eventually left. But while I was there, because we were told we might go back when we got back to the States.
You said that you meet every year on October 23rd with a bunch of other guys.
Yeah.
And that's – you're going to meet –
yeah, we will be. I'll be in camp. I'll fly out to Jacksonville on the 20th, and every 5 years we try to go to every fifth-year memorial as a group. We rent a house in Topsail Island, take all of our kids, and we try to stay the whole week just being together because it's very healing.
How many of you usually show up for this?
7 to 9. They were all in the same platoon, and we have some guys from other companies, other Charlie Company or weapons that will come by, and we usually have a get-together with everybody. Our lieutenant, retired colonel, David Hoag, was our second lieutenant in Beirut, and he's still going strong.
City of Jacksonville planted a tree along a certain boulevard.
They did.
Are they still thriving?
They are. Well, I was there a couple years ago, and they were still there. They put ribbons around them every October 23rd for each veteran that was killed. Mm-hmm. You know, but Jacksonville, they put it out. They do it right. Every year. But being able to see the guys, because we're scattered. Again, I joined the Marine Corps in Mississippi, and all my buddies are from the north northeast. From Boston, from Pennsylvania, from New York, Maine. I'm the only Southern guy there, you know. There's a bond that is unbreakable. For those guys, they're a second family. They're a second family.
Right. And are you in touch throughout the year too? Like,
oh yeah, we FaceTime, we call. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we get together throughout the year for other things if we can. But we always try to keep in touch. My wife goes crazy because there's a text group that goes, and we're on it every day.
Ding ding,
yeah. Every day, and of course, she's on that group. I said, you gotta put up with it. You know?
How many Marines survived the explosion? Do you know?
I do not know. At one time, I did. I can't remember on how many were there. That's a good question. I could call my doc. Doc Hackler could tell you. He knows all that stuff. Mm-hmm. He's a historian.
I don't know how many, but I know that there were some who were severely wounded, and were like in living in veterans' homes, had lost limbs and so forth, but I don't know the numbers either.
Yeah.
Are they being taken care of adequately? Do you feel like you were?
I couldn't answer that.
I'm disabled from the PTSD, but I'm one of those guys that didn't want to have any help. So it took me 30-something years to realize that I needed help.
Yeah.
But I still – I think there are more people – there's more men and women now today that need it worse than I. So I don't know the answer to that question. Are they being treated? Mm. I hear stories, of course. I don't know if you ever heard of 22 Kill.
No.
I'm one of the guys that support 22 Kill. 22 Kill is a advocacy group for veterans. Mm-hmm. 22 vets commit suicide every day in the U.S. Mm-hmm. Used to be more, but 22 is way too many. Way too many. So there's still improvement the VA can do, and I think – I don't care what party line you're on. They both will agree to it. They just have to agree to do the right things and make it happen.
Yeah.
You know? So I don't know the answer to that question, Ron.
How can we keep the memory alive? How can we civilians, we people that just
– What you're doing now. I mean, you know, the podcast, the talking about it, educating people, reminding people that these men – their lives were cut short by a brutal attack, and they were serving this country that gives us so much more than we deserve, the freedoms we have. I think this type of thing, just people hearing it and remembering that this did happen, and we honor these men in every way we can.
And they were heroes.
Yes.
What are you doing now? I know you said you got four businesses. Tell us a little bit about what your life is like now.
Yeah, my wife and I have four small businesses here in St. Louis. We opened the first OsteoStrong in Creve Coeur going on 8 years ago. I spent 30 years in the corporate world and retired and then went back to work a lot harder, working harder in my 60s than I ever did in my 50s. But what we do at OsteoStrong is we do skeletal strength conditioning. We have a system that allows you to put pressure on your bone and trigger new bone tissue growth. So we help with balance, strength, and bone density, but it's holistic. It's not exercise. I work with a lot of vets. I've jacked my body up between, you know, back when I was a kid as a rodeo clown or riding bronc to fighting, competing in martial arts to doing stupid things. But it helps. We've got 9 locations in St. Louis now. It's a fastest growing holistic franchise in the state of Missouri. And we have people from 9 years old to 99-year-old doing this once a week. But the four machines allow you to basically emulate high impact like a gymnast. Gymnasts have the strongest bone, the best bone density, the densest muscles, and the best balance. Mm. And our system allows you to do the same thing a gymnast does without the threat of injury or greatly reducing threat of injury because it's not exercise. And I own 3 of those, and we also own an imaging center, so I do body composition, bone density scans as well. Then I have some therapies. I have 2 holistic therapies. One of them that I work with vets with is called NuCalm, NuCalm. And NuCalm is where stress meets neuroscience. And it's a sound wave that you listen to music that triggers your brain to go from alpha to theta, which very quickly. So 20 minutes is equivalent to 2 hours of deep restorative sleep. Mm. And it's now a phone app, so you can do it at home. Mm. I've got beds, but you can do it at home. So a lot of vets have now been approved at the VA hospital in Virginia. But, for stress and PTSD or anxiety, NuCalm, you can get that on your
great.
Phone. Yeah, so I have that. I have 2 beds at my center. And I have a 14-year-old, so playing hockey.
We're running out of time rapidly, but I want to see if any of you have any final thoughts or anything else you'd like to say before we close.
I just want to thank you. Thank you, Joe and John. It was an honor to meet you.
Thank you.
And I appreciate and respect and the sacrifice your family made for our country and your son and your brother. And I hope that we always remember and honor your son and your brother the way we need to. And Ron, thank you for making this happen.
Thank you. Thank you. And I really appreciate all 3 of you. Do you have anything you want to share before I?
No.
Okay. I appreciate all 3 of you coming here. I know this is not easy. I'll never forget Scott's sacrifice. I know Johnny won't. I'll never forget the sacrifices that those men made, those heroes made. So, again, I appreciate your coming here. God bless America. Semper Fi.
Semper Fi.
Semper Fi. You've been listening to Stories of New Americans on News Talk STL 101.9, 94.1. Thank you for listening.
Stories of New Americans with Ron Clutho on News Talk STL.
And I'm proud to be an American, where at least I know I'm free. And I won't forget the men who died, who gave that right to me. And I gladly stand up next to you and defend her still today. 'Cause there ain't no doubt I love this land.